This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. When we think of sustainability, we tend to think of environmentally friendly initiatives to help make the planet a better place. And while that's true, there's still plenty of other layers to the challenge of creating a sustainable city. So what are those layers, and how is Central Florida leading the charge to become a sustainable community? Joining us in the studio, Chris Castro. He's the Director of Sustainability for the City of Orlando. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Clayton Lewis-Ferrara, Executive Director of Ideas for Us. Clayton, thanks.
Pleasure's all mine.
And Ken LaRoe, Founder and CEO of First Green Bank. Ken, thanks for your time.
Glad to be here.
Chris, I want to start with you. Let's define sustainability first. What does it mean to live sustainably?
I think sustainability is really about meeting the needs of today without compromising the needs of future generations to come. And, you know, when we think about sustainability in the city of Orlando, it really looks at the triple bottom line. How do we enhance quality of life and public health? How do we improve the economic viability and robustness of our city? And also, of course, protecting the natural resources and the environment, you know, for now and into the future. And so from a city's perspective, it's really about what are the types of policies and programs that we can implement across our various services that will essentially achieve a better future for all.
You're the City of Orlando's Director of Sustainability. At what point did the city make a conscious effort to start looking at sustainability and looking at maintaining a sustainable lifestyle for its citizens?
So Mayor Dyer actually 10 years ago in 2007 launched Greenworks Orlando, and his vision was to become the most environmentally friendly, socially inclusive, and economically vibrant city in the nation. And, you know, as part of that, we were first and foremost looking at ourselves. The idea was to build a municipal operations sustainability plan that looks at all of our internal operations, our fleet vehicles, how we operate our facilities, our water consumption, even our procurement, and figuring out ways in which the City of Orlando can lower its footprint and drive and accelerate sustainability. In 2013, Mayor Dyer brought together a task force of community leaders, and we ended up developing what's known as the Community Sustainability Action Plan, really looking outward to the types of policies, programs, and partnerships that we can all make in order to work together in making Orlando the most sustainable city in the country.
Now, what are some of those initiatives that you're working on as the City of Orlando Sustainability Director that you're working on now or coming up in the near future?
Yeah, there's in each one of the focused areas that we work on, and I kind of just outlined those, we have a series of really great programs going on. I'll talk about, you know, solid waste as an example. I often say that humans are the only living thing on this planet that produce non-biodegradable waste. And over the course of, you know, however long we can remember, we've been throwing this stuff into a hole and expecting it to essentially sit there forever and not realizing that there are valuable commodities within the waste stream that we could be using and repurposing. So about 2 years ago, in partnership with the Solid Waste Division of the city, we decided to address food waste, primarily organics, and figure out how we can take food waste out of the waste stream and either create compost or we can create energy. So we launched two programs. One's a backyard composter program. Now upwards of 5,000 households across Orlando have received a free composter for their backyard, and they can put their food scraps, they can put their yard waste, and make fresh, nutritious soil for either their garden or their shrubs and their trees around their property. The second program I think is really innovative, and that's a commercial food waste collection program where we work with hotels, with restaurants and other food service industries, and we provide not only the cart, but the collection service to pick up organic waste from that waste stream.
So this would be like food scraps or leftovers?
Yep. Leftovers, even, you know, spoiled foods, and even, of course, being the hospitality hub of the country, the catering industry here is extremely wasteful, right? And so a lot of that stuff normally ends up into the landfill, and we launched this new program and now take that food waste to an anaerobic biogas plant, an anaerobic digester, down by Reedy Creek, in partnership with Disney and the Reedy Creek Improvement District, and turn that food waste into electricity that gets fed onto the electric grid and utilized in the Central Florida region. So really creative ways of minimizing the amount of waste we're sending to the landfill and maximizing the benefits and the value of that commodity.
Is this a tough sell for you working for the city to get citizens in Orlando to buy into these? I mean, you said 5,000 composter. That seems like quite a bit. How did you get so many people to participate in that program?
I'll tell you, the Office of Communications and Neighborhood Relations at the city are probably the best in the entire country. The talent that we have that thought through different creative campaigns. We have this campaign called Get Dirty, and we first launched it for Valentine's Day, Get Dirty for Valentine's Day, and encouraged people to get a free composter for your gift for the significant other. And then we said Get Dirty with your neighbor and try to encourage neighbors who have these composters to invite their neighbors. And that program has scaled tremendously. In fact, we've received awards for the Get Dirty program at a national level. We've gotten a lot of other communities saying, how do I create these creative marketing campaigns? And so that's been a really successful way to get the word out. In addition to waste, we're also rolling out recycling in the downtown. So that's been a big priority for Mayor Dyer and, of course, our downtown development board. So we recently rolled out some Big Belly smart trash cans. And these trash cans have some sensors, and they provide real-time data about how full the bins are. They're helping us to identify ways we can make our collection more efficient and saving money at the same time.
You're not worried about a trash can overrising when they get too smart at this point?
Not yet, no.
Well, Clayton, I want to switch gears to you. Ideas for Us looks at projects outside the city, looks at more of a global perspective of things. What are some of the big challenges that Ideas for Us is tackling this year?
Yeah, so even though we are an organization that has no borders or geographic limits, Orlando is still very much our home. You know, it's where the organization was founded and started, and where our global headquarters are. So very often we have the relationship of piloting projects here, learning about the execution of them, especially because Orlando is a very resourceful community and a diverse community. So we've got many colleges here that are wonderful testing beds for programs with students, many, many different neighborhoods facing a mosaic of challenges. So it's a good testing ground for bringing a lot of these things different places. As far as what we're tackling this year, we're really excited to bring The Hive to a much larger audience this year.
And what is The Hive?
Yeah, The Hive is a community program that we have, and it's been around 5 years now. It started almost 5 years, February of 2013. We came up with the idea. It meets monthly on the first Wednesday of every month. We bring an intergenerational, interdisciplinary group together. We focus on a sustainability topic with an expert speaker that gives us a little bit of wisdom. But then we break out to tackle a problem, a proposed issue in the community, kind of grind on that. We have some whiteboards, have some markers, use some human-centered design-related things, and then come up with an action project. And we always hold that on the last Saturday of every month. So right now, The Hive is held at in Audubon Park at East End Market on the second floor on the first Wednesday of every month at 6:45. But there are many, many other places to scale this. We've held Hives and done action projects with The Hive in many different countries. But 2018, we're wanting to start different satellite groups in Orlando, particularly looking at West Orange County and West Orlando. And those are areas that could really benefit from community projects that aren't us coming in there and directing what needs to happen, but helping people in those communities to give them the tool set that they need, the conceptualization of projects, even the project funding, to then do what their vision of their community is.
So allow the citizens to find the solutions to the problem. Right?
You'd be surprised how simple that is, but how difficult and also how uncommon that approach is. You know, Ideas for Us were the only organization in Central Florida that's part of the UN. And that gives us a very interesting perspective on things because we're able to see how many other entities work on these projects at the global level. And the projects that work have tremendous community buy-in. The ones that fail and become notorious, money pits for many of these global aid projects have people coming in from outside into the community, kind of commanding what's going to happen, have very little buy-in, and we're hyper aware of not being that.
What are some of those projects that have come out of The Hive here locally that are kind of success stories for your organization?
Yeah, there's been a lot. our projects are really diverse. Originally, we focused on five pillars of sustainability. It's our own approach to kind of unpacking sustainability because it can be very complex to people. So we started with energy, water, food, waste, and ecology. Traditionally, the Hive has three roles. We're creating action projects in the community. We're also bringing people on field trips to many places in the community as well to see the power plant, see the water treatment facility, the landfill, different types of nature preserves or artificial wetlands, and then mimic those kinds of things in the community. So one of my favorite projects that we've done in the past is called Aquatic Planting Day. And what we do is we find a retention pond, kind of a classic Florida apartment retention pond where it's just grass.
Waterfront property.
Exactly, right? Just grass sloping down into a ditch. Well, there's a whole cascade of environmental problems that happen when that's a congregation point for pollution. It can damage our springs. It can get into the main waterways, cause eutrophication, all of these problems. But it's also a way of rebuilding biodiversity hotspots in small scale. In kind of a mosaic across neighborhoods, and no one is doing that. So we rip up the grass around the retention pond. We build a littoral zone of wetland plants that are all native and have a high habitat value, and it turns into a beautiful oasis for native wildlife. Another project that came out of the Hive infamously is Fleet Farming. And Fleet Farming is our urban agricultural program. We've been on the station before speaking about it, which is really exciting. And basically, it's a simple idea of grow food, not lawns, and use a method of transportation to do the farming that isn't part of the industrial agricultural system adding to climate change. So we use bicycles as that solution.
Ken Leroux, I want to bring you into the conversation because your business is quite unique here. First Green Bank, it's a mission-oriented business. What does that mean?
Well, it started with an environmental focus, and we thought that we could move the needle on environmental issues by giving an interest rate discount as an example for environmental projects that were LEED certified or U.S. Green Building Coalition certified, that kind of thing. Didn't get enough takers. It was right during the meltdown. So then we thought, well, we got to do something else. And we came up with a solar power financing program that was, again, no taker. So we just kept tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it until it got so good that it was too good to refuse, you know. And we now have hundreds and hundreds of solar loans across Central Florida. My dream being that people drive into Central Florida go, oh, my gosh, look at all that solar. I wonder where it came from. Hadn't happened yet, but we're getting there. Over time, the mission, if you will, morphed to include a lot more. And it kind of was the turning point was when we joined the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, which is an international nonprofit based in the Netherlands of financial institutions worldwide that are doing good stuff, everything from micro-lending to environmental stuff. And amazingly, we're kind of at the forefront of the environmental members in that organization, which is just really shocks me that a bank in Central Florida is doing more than some of the banks in Europe and stuff. But that kind of opened my eyes to other things, like social equity, financial inclusion, stuff that is a very real problem in America that most Americans don't even know exists. 28% of the population of America is unbanked, at least in the traditional sense.
And what does that mean?
No checking account, no access to the financial system as we know it. So they end up paying a lot higher costs to just do simple transactions like cash or paycheck.
28%, that's wild.
28%. It's incredible. And what the reason is because there's a system that financial institutions use that's a self-reporting system. That we're all familiar with the credit bureau on the lending side, but there's another system that if anything shows up on the deposit side, for instance, somebody charges off overdraws their account and the bank has a write-off, it goes into this check system is what it's called. Mm. And whenever we open an account, we pull a check systems report. If somebody's reported on there, we don't open the account. And the light bulb went off one day. I was looking through my board reports, and I noticed there were 28 people that we turned down for checking accounts that month, out of the however many, 250 that we opened. I said, what's the deal? Let me look at their report. And it was a gal that had a $38 charge off at Bank of America.
And that was preventing her from opening up another account elsewhere.
Yeah. And there were the people that had a $3,000 fraud. Mm-hmm. Of course, nobody wants to bank them and shouldn't. They shouldn't be banked. So we developed a product that would give people a second chance to redeem themselves on the check. I mean, that's just one small thing that most people don't even know happens out there.
Now, you mentioned this earlier when you first opened up the bank and offering these low interest loans to either LEED certified groups or companies that were kind of green centric. As the economy starts to grow a little bit more and there's more money being bumped into the system, are you starting to see more and more of these environmentally focused groups and companies opening up and grabbing loans from you guys?
Unfortunately, no. We're not influencing the decision to do a more sustainable project. There's people that are interested, and usually it's a professional. It'll be a physician or an attorney or something that will have the most interest in doing that. A commercial developer never has the interest in doing it. It's just an added cost. They can't reflect it in their lease, so it doesn't make economic sense. The good thing I would say is that the local building codes have gotten so much better that a regular old run-of-the-mill garden variety building is way more efficient than they used to be. It doesn't take much to get them to LEED Silver, but nobody's going to spend the $30,000 it takes to get to LEED Silver or whatever the number is. So it's yes, it's increased a little bit incrementally, but we try, and a number of myself and my coworkers are LEED APs or LEED Green Associates. We have a program where we pay our coworkers to take the course, take the test, and then we give them a $1,000 a year raise if they become a LEED Green Associate. So we've got a whole bunch of our folks that can talk the talk, you know, on that. So,
do you think that there'll be a time when there's more smaller business or entrepreneurs coming to you with, you know, these green businesses or sustainably focused business asking for a little bit of a loan from you? Is it growing?
Yes, that is definitely growing. And the more, you know, Chris and Clayton influence the community, which is tremendous. I mean, these two guys have a tremendous influence on the community. It's becoming more and more aware. People are wanting to do it.
It's kind of like building a culture. You know, I think Orlando's really in the process of building a culture really driven by millennial and the younger generation who are really realizing the importance of how sustainability and innovation and technology play a role in our future. And a lot of the work that we've been doing in the city of Orlando is trying to figure out how do we attract the creative class to stay here in Orlando, build small businesses, bank with local banks like First Green Bank, get involved with organizations like Ideas for Us. How do we build that culture of community engagement that I think we're starting to see really move the needle, especially over the course of the last 5 years?
There's a lot of kind of the moving of the veil that was covering all of these intersectionalities that exist in sustainability. It's like the quote about ecology, where you pull one thread in nature and you see everything else is also attached. So I think that you're seeing more and more that sustainability issues also overlie with social justice issues, also overlie with cultural issues and just the larger story of where we're moving as a country and as humanity itself. And, you know, eco-racism is a real thing. Eco-justice is certainly something that many communities struggle with that are tremendously environmentally degraded and damaged, even here in our own city, and lead to many of those systematic problems that turn out to not being able to open a bank account, right? So there's sustainability intertwined in all of this because to boil it down, in addition to Chris's definition, it's people and it's the planet and it's also prosperity in our community. Those three things are inseparable from sustainability. And I mean, even though these things are a huge boost to Orlando being a hotspot, I am not someone who believes that these advances are unique to just Orlando. I think that other cities absolutely can see the work that's happening here as a blueprint. Mm-hmm. It takes three to tango in this kind of setting. You have to have, in our civic society, in order to move it forward, you have to have cooperation in the public sector, the private sector, and the independent sector, which is where nonprofits dwell. Mm-hmm. And only by having that kind of cohesion between the three of them to advance is where you start to see some really serious gains.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking back over the last decade of things going on in Orlando, it's awe-inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
I have the same feeling that 10 years from now, I'll be looking back and my mind will be even more blown because mm-hmm. this is a momentum that's building.
It's the culture of collaborations and partnerships that has set Orlando apart in a lot of different respects, including sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important point to realize in the current state of Orlando is you have each one of these agencies and private sector and the independent and the civil society who mm-hmm. are all coming together to rally and move our city forward.
With that said, how are you working for the city of Orlando, helping out sister cities across Florida? What kind of collaboration is there?
Totally. That's a great question. So Orlando is a part of several different networks, and one of those is called the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, or USDN. USDN is about 350 of my counterparts in different cities around the country, from Boulder to Austin to Mobile, Alabama to Knoxville, Tennessee. I mean, all the major cities and even in the Americas. And we not only collaborate on an intraweb that we have where we're sharing policies and resources and questions about challenges we may be facing, but we meet on a regular basis. We have also a regional network, so we're part of the Florida Sustainability Directors Network as well. And there's about 40 different governments, both city and county governments, who have started to come together and do the same thing. How do mm-hmm. we share best practices, leverage our own resources, build these coalitions among cities to move the agenda forward? And I think what we saw earlier this year with mayors doubling down on their commitments to reducing pollution and greenhouse gas emissions after President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement was historic. We had mm-hmm. never seen that in history.
Never.
340 mayors came together in a matter of a week through that network of USDN, and we all said, mm-hmm. this is not what we're about. This is not what we stand for. And in fact, we're all going to come together and double down on a coalition. It's called the We Are Still In Coalition. You've probably seen it. And that included not just cities and counties, but states, academia, and the private sector all coming together and saying, we're still going to move in the right direction, regardless of what the federal government thinks about climate change, about our environmental state, and about the quality of life of our country.
Ken LaRoe, is that how you feel that these issues with climate change and creating a healthy environment, sustainability, is that how it's going to happen? Is this going to be a grassroots thing and not a top-down thing with the current political climate the way it is?
I think it's absolutely going to be a grassroots thing from the ground up. And then talking about the community influence that Chris was talking about, I mean, Chris and Clay probably don't realize it, but they're really the reason I'm headquartered in Orlando now. We started in Lake County where I was born. It's logical that I'd want to do something there, but I could get no traction in Lake County. And through Chris's introduction to the mayor, and the mayor just asked me to, you know, where's your headquarters? Well, it's in Mount Dora, you know, and then I'm thinking, not for long. So
we worked together and got them down there.
And now we're the only city skyline that has a green bank with their name on a building. It's really exciting.
In the world.
In the world.
In the world.
Yeah, and it was you guys from the grassroots up.
Ken LaRoe, he's the founder and CEO of First Green Bank. Ken, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Clayton Lewis Ferrara is the executive director of Ideas for Us. Clayton, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure's all mine.
And Chris Castro, director of sustainability for the city of Orlando. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up, Michael Seely is a healthcare executive by day, but any other time, he's chasing rockets.
For me, it's that sort of evocative, kind of emotional moment, because every rocket launch you see, at least I see, is extremely emotional. It is, you know, powerful. It is romantic. I mean, to think about someday we'll be, you know, launching humans atop these, you know, these powerful rocket engines, and you know, and so yeah. So for me, it's not so much the visual or the aesthetic. It's the sort of the feeling when you look at it.
A day in the life of a launch photographer on the Space Coast. That's ahead when Intersection returns. We'll be right back. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne. When you see a rocket streaking through the central Florida sky, you can bet Michael Seeley was at the launch pad hours before liftoff, wading through clouds of mosquitoes and early morning dew to capture the few seconds of a rocket launching into the sky. By day, Seeley is a healthcare executive, but his passion for space gets him up early mornings to set up launch shots that have graced the pages of National Geographic. So you've got a full-time job, you're in healthcare, you're a fundraiser, but you also are a launch photographer. How did you make that transition?
Yeah, it was, I'm not even sure I would call it a transition. It was almost an additive thing. When I moved to the Space Coast in 2012, it hadn't even really occurred to me. I mean, I knew that launches took place here, but it really wasn't until one night when we were out back, might have been in the pool, and I saw a bright light in the sky, and I just sort of said, hey, wait a minute, that's a rocket. And from that point, I think the hook, the kind of the pivotal moment in my obsession with spaceflight was actually a NASA social event that I applied to and participated in. I would list this next section of the interview as just a great billboard for the NASA social program.
Now, for listeners who don't know, what is the NASA social program?
So NASA social was something that was created. I thought it was a new thing, but I was woefully mistaken. It used to be called the Tweet Up, and it is a program that NASA launched a few years ago, wherein people who have a passion for space and have a social media following. It doesn't even have to be a large one, really. I mean, they're just sort of focusing on passion, are invited to participate in spaceflight-related activities, to a large extent gaining the same level of access that members in the media have. And so a group of 25 or 50 people, like I'm aware of for the last shuttle, they brought 50, maybe 100, I don't know, a lot of people in from the community to witness that. And they're allowed to go on tours of the vehicle assembly building. They're allowed to see and interact with facilities and projects that, the standard public don't get to see. And they're invited to take pictures and talk about it on social media. It is great. It is just a great program.
Well, did you always have a knack for photography before this?
Yes and no. I worked at a camera store in a mini lab back in the 80s. I'm old enough to have actually shot with real film. And I think as a film photographer, I was certainly passionate, but I don't think I was great at it. And digital photography, I mean, I think I'm more of a technologist or a technology nerd than anything else. And so the ease of use of digital equipment and then the, digital post-processing, I think, has made me a better photographer. And so, a lot of the excitement that surrounds this, it's the hardware and, and the romance of spaceflight, but it is also the technical aspects of capturing these images that are very, very difficult to, expose and capture and post-process. And in that regard, I have a real enthusiasm for trying to figure out the nuts and bolts of, of how that all works, that capturing and post-processing process.
Walk us through, a launch day. Take our listeners through that.
There's a lot of planning that goes into it ahead of time. And, we get an idea. We know what the launch window is going to be. And for a classified payload, that can sometimes be tricky because they'll elongate the launch window to not reveal the classified nature of the mission. But that's all relevant because when we're planning our shots, we need to know the lighting conditions when the rocket's going to go, right?
So night or day.
Right? Night or day, but also position of the sun, position of the moon. The moon, ends up being an issue for long exposure shots. And with all that in mind, we approach the day of launch, with a pretty good idea where we're going to set our cameras and what our shots are going to look like. The preparation also involves a lot of charging of batteries, assembling the remote enclosures for the cameras. And so the day of the launch, we are often out there, and this benefits me having a day job. The remote camera setups often take place like well before sunrise. And mm-hmm. so, we'll meet at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., covered in mosquito or bug spray, and go out to the pad. And we'll select our shots, select our positions, and set up the cameras. The camera setup, we have to secure the tripods to the ground, make sure that the camera's active, set the shot, set it manually. We use remote or sound-activated triggers to fire the cameras. And so a lot of that is, you know, we cross our fingers and hope the cameras are still, the batteries haven't died, you know, or that the even the batteries in the sound triggers work when the rocket launches.
This is hours before the launch happens, you're out there.
We're setting it hours before the launch happens. And then many times if there's a scrub or, well, if there's a scrub, the camera will sit out there. I've had cameras sit out there for 3 days untended.
Wow.
You know, and it's almost, it's like kind of like Christmas morning. There's a romance to, you know, returning to the pad after the rocket's gone off and, you know, and breaking open the enclosure and hoping the battery, you know, lasted that long and seeing what kind of images you get. There, you know, there's a lot of variability in it. You know, every photographer that sets a camera, you know, forgets to do something. I mean, I've left lens caps on, for example.
Oh,
you know, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. But when it goes right, it is very gratifying to see that image on the camera LCD. It's one of the coolest things that we get to do.
What was your first remote camera shot like? Was it perfect?
No, it was terrible. No, the first remote that I set. First of all, I should say, the spaceflight photographic community is politely competitive, but by and large, very collegial. And the other thing that I'll say is that every shot that I get that is good, chances are someone's done it a few times or many times before me. And, you know, so I have the benefit of having been guided by or counseled by some of the finest people in this business, Mike Brown, Julian Leake, you know, Mike Killian, the guys I work with, Jared Hayworth, you know, Bill Jelen. These are just really great resources. Having said all that, the first remote that I sat was for an Atlas V mission, probably in 2015, I think. And it was an interesting issue. It rained constantly after I set that remote. And the interesting thing that I found out is if you set the sound-activated trigger to be too sensitive, raindrops on the enclosure will cause it to fire. And when I went back the next day to wipe it down because the launch was scrubbed because of the weather, I had 16,000 shots of a rainy Atlas V, you know, sitting on the pad. And so I reset that. I had happened to bring another battery with me. And, I reset it and then left. It then sat out there for 2 days before the rocket went. And in that particular case, when I went back after the rocket, I realized that the water had accumulated in the enclosure and it shorted out the trigger. And so there was absolutely nothing there. I've had shots that have been out of focus, actually, because you can't use out of focus. And so sometimes if the rocket's not on the pad, and this might have been the second remote that I set, when I went back the next day, it was just blurry. It was just almost an embarrassingly blurry photo.
How do you account for, you know, it's a white rocket on a blue sky with all of this light coming from the engine exhaust? How do you account for all that stuff? Is there a lot of math? Is it just a standard settings you go to?
It's kind of standard settings. You know, the other thing it'll point to is that there are, you know, photographer Ben Cooper. I would tell anyone aspiring, you know, to be a launch photographer, look at Ben Cooper's webpage. You know, also Bill Ingalls, the legendary NASA photographer. It's important to remember that a lot of the images just go out as public domain images. Like if you go to Flickr, right, and look at the NASA feed, you'll find images that are just like the ones that we're taking, and they leave all the data on the image. And so you can look in Flickr and you can see their exposure settings. And so in many cases, we're just sort of basing it on what we've seen others do. And so, yeah, it is complicated to account for the severe, you know, ranges in light and color. But, you know, but we managed to do it.
What makes a good shot? What makes a good picture of a rocket launch?
It kind of varies. My thinking has evolved a little bit. You know, I used to be fine with these, like, sort of sweeping wide shots. It's kind of personal preference, I guess is what I'll say. You know, I used to be really fine with sweeping wide shots with the, you know, sort of exhaust covering the pad and the rocket, you know, sort of shooting up. The first time that I took an image very, very close, a remote image, you know, just showing, like, the nozzle of the rocket, and so you can feel the power, that kind of appealed to me also. For me, what makes a shot good is if I kind of feel something when I see it. You know, if I can feel the heat of the rocket or if I can, you know, sort of imagine what it felt like when that sound, you know, kind of hit me. That for me, it's that sort of evocative, kind of emotional moment, because every rocket launch you see, at least I see, is extremely emotional. It is, you know, powerful. It is romantic. I mean, to think about someday we'll be, you know, launching humans atop these, you know, these powerful rocket engines, and you know, and so for me, it's not so much the visual or the aesthetic; it's the sort of the feeling when you look at it.
Is there any particular launch that sticks out in your mind as one of your favorites, or a particular shot that? I know it's like asking which one of your kids is your favorite, but is there a particular shot that really stands out that says this is my favorite, this is my good work?
Probably it's a two part and they're kind of related. You know, going back to the answer I gave a moment ago about how you feel, mm-hmm. I will never forget Orbcomm or OG2 in December of, I think it was 2015, and the narrative was pretty compelling, at least to me. It was after SpaceX had the anomaly. Their return to flight was a commercial communication satellite launched by Orbcomm, and that was the first time that they were bringing a rocket back to land, and you know, or the first stage of, you know, of the Falcon 9. And I will never forget sitting at Jetty Park, watching that rocket come back, and it was night, and so all we could really see was just that entry burn, and. You know, and the thing about that was we all kind of, and there were a bunch of us there in the park watching it, and we all kind of turned to each other and said, holy cow, that is coming right for us. And sure enough, it was, really. I mean, it was landing just like 4 miles to the north of us. And that was when I thought to myself, this is really going to happen. Like, it was like nothing we'd ever seen. And the sonic booms pretty much convinced us that it had exploded on impact, but in fact, it hadn't. And, you know, and so that image actually was kind of, it was one of the most viewed images that I had taken at the time. It was kind of like the Guardian ran it. The Smithsonian Magazine ran an image of a long exposure of the launch streak and the landing streak. Those two streaks in the image, no one had ever seen that because it was the first rocket, really, that we had seen mm-hmm. come back to land. The part B of that question is CRS-9. When that rocket came back to land, I captured a single image, a 483-second exposure of that launch and landing, all in the same frame, and that was the image that National Geographic ran in their print edition almost a year ago, November 2016. And just seeing that, I'll never forget that.
You mentioned that rocket launches are emotional. You talked about the excitement of seeing that land, and it's kind of silly to think about, you know, how people like us get excited and emotional about, you know, metal and steel and fuel. But maybe you can explain, you know, why do you have such an emotional attachment to these machines?
Well, because they're improbable, right? I mean, it's improbable, but also the human element of it. You know, first of all, the number of people that are involved in it and the just sort of the sheer you know, planning and resources that go into flying it. It is a Herculean effort to begin with. But then to ponder that every piece of equipment that we get to watch, well, the Atlas and the Falcon 9, you know, ULA's Atlas 5 and then SpaceX's Falcon 9 will, in the not-too-distant future, cynics will, you know, question the timeline, but in the not-too-distant future, will carry humans to the International Space Station. And so to think about, you know, people putting their trust in a rocket, just intuitively, like this is, you know, they explode. They, you know, I mean, the amount of thrust that comes out of them, it's just overwhelming, I guess is what I would say. And so it is, I'm not sure I'm explaining it right necessarily, but it just to me, it is the improbable, amazing nature of what we're looking at that makes it just so inspiring and emotional for me.
Cool. Well, we'll post some of your favorites on our website, WMFE.org.
Oh, cool.
So, Michael Seeley, launch photographer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me in.
Coming up, a trip to the Harp and Celt pub for a traditional Irish fiddle jam. How one couple has kept the spirit of Irish folk music alive here in Central Florida for nearly two decades. That's ahead when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne. Pint glasses full of stout and cider pepper a small table in the back corner of downtown Orlando's Harp and Celt. Around it, musicians are unpacking fiddles, flutes, banjos, and guitars ahead of the every other Wednesday session. Jam Session leaders Vicky Gish and Scott Vaca started the group more than 15 years ago at another Irish pub. When that spot closed down, they found a new place to play traditional Irish folk tunes. I met the group for a session.
Vicky, tell us, what is a fiddle session? What are we about to see tonight?
Well, a traditional Irish music session is a gathering of Irish musicians that are people that play Irish music. They don't have to be Irish. And just play traditional Irish instruments and the traditional tunes. Jigs, reels, hornpipes, slip jigs, you know, polkas, so various tunes that we play. So it's these are shared tunes that are known all over the world. And if you know the tune, you play it. And if you don't, you sit it out. And it's just kind of a social gathering of musicians.
Scott, how did you get involved in playing in sessions like this?
I'd been playing music for a while in different various forms and lived in Tampa at the time, tried to find some sessions there and just never really found one and never really found the crowd of people that played traditional music. Then a job opportunity led me to Orlando, and I started looking here and ended up finding the Claddagh Cottage Pub and found Vicky and a few other people that played in an Irish rock band that was traditional based, and kind of got involved with that and started playing traditional music through that about 2000.
So Vicky, what makes it a session? Is there something that you have to have that makes this a true to form session, or is it just a bunch of musicians coming together and having a good time?
Well, you pretty much have to play an instrument that's acceptable in a session, which is, you know, fiddle and guitar and flute and
pipes, banjo, button accordion, whistles.
Yeah, I've seen other instruments.
Baron.
Yeah, oh, of course, the baron, which is
what's that?
The Irish drum. It's okay. A frame drum that you hit with a stick with in the other hand.
Kind of looks like a big serving platter, right? A big
right.
Round disc
held vertically. Yeah, and yeah, so basically play that one of these types of instruments, and then of course know the tunes that are played.
Are there any rules? Are there any unwritten rules, things you shouldn't do, things you have to do? What do you need to know going into this?
Pretty much one rule is if you don't know the tune, don't play it. You know, you don't want any what we call noodling, which is just kind of like figuring out the notes. If maybe it sounds like this or that. If you're, you know, some good musicians can kind of come into this even if they're not familiar with the genre and they think they're, you know, they can play along. But even still, it's not really... it's not really acceptable to kind of just play around the tune. You should actually play the notes of the tune.
And how do you do that? There's no sheet music. There's nothing out there. How do musicians know what to play?
You learn the tunes. You know, it's like people are amazed at how many tunes that we know in our heads. But I mean, you learn a song and you know the song. Like, you know, Happy Birthday, and you can hum that tune. So you could play that tune if you know that. So you just get it in your head. You listen to it a lot. And until it comes out of your fingers, yeah.
Now, Vicky, how long has this session been going on? How did it start? How did you get involved in it? I mean, it's got a storied history. It's been around for a long time.
I was in a band at the time, and he ended up joining that band. And then the band kind of fell apart, and Scott and I were more interested in the traditional Irish music, which the band didn't really play too much of. It was more covers and original songs that were written. And so he persuaded me to go down to the pub and just start playing some tunes, just he and I. And then we started making it a regular thing on a Tuesday. And then we started meeting people that were interested in it. They started playing with us, and it just has grown ever since. And it became a Wednesday session the day after 9/11, actually, in 2001. We'd shifted it to Wednesday to accommodate another session player's schedule, so been that way ever since. So that was how we started it. He kind of dragged me down to the pub.
Who are some of the musicians that that will play with you? I mean, are these professional musicians? Are these amateur musicians? Who sits down at these sessions with you?
All levels sit down at our session. I mean, we get from people that are just learning their instrument to professionals that are working professionally as musicians and happen to be coming through Orlando or living in Orlando or maybe working at Disney or getting off of a cruise ship, having played the cruise ship. So, and then we got lots of people that are just here on vacation or here for a a conference. And so people look us up because there's a website called thesession.org where you can look up where the sessions are all over the world. And so they find us there. And that's how they just walk in. Sometimes we don't get a notification that they're coming in. They just walk in. So that's cool. We meet a lot of people.
Now, can you kind of describe what it sounds like? Well, we're going to hear from the session, but I mean, it's like this wall of sound that comes out. What can you expect to hear if you're sitting here as a spectator of a session?
Well, somebody starts a tune or has a discussion about what tune we're going to play. Sometimes people just launch into a tune, and then everybody just joins in that knows that tune. So it could be, you know, fiddle and or flute or Ilan pipes. And banjo and bouzouki guitar. So people just trickle in when they want to, basically. And it can be a wall of sound, you know, if it's especially a tune that everybody knows, you know. And it depends on the size of the group, too, because sessions can be as small as two people, which is a very small session, hardly a session, but up to, we've had crazy big sessions, 17 people. That's just kind of too big, but...
Now, Scott, if someone's to come down to the Harp and Celt while you guys are still here to see one of these sessions, what's the etiquette? How should they observe? What do you want them to get from it? Walk us through it.
Well, it's organic. It's folk music, after all. It's meant to be in a setting where it's not overproduced and over-arranged, really. Those kind of performances are nice, and they're good for concert halls. But I think for pubs and session... atmosphere should be lively and free-flowing and not constrained by what people want to hear. You kind of have to listen to what the players want to do for a while, you know, and that's what's organic about it. People play, when we get people that listen and we know people are paying attention, we recognize that, we see that, you know, and when people are loud and don't notice us, we recognize that too. But we play on regardless. It's a pub, but we don't expect it to be a performance. It's what you expect when you're a session musician. You expect the pub to just, it's organic. They're either going to be quiet and listen, or they're going to be noisy and play on, and you just got to carry on no matter what.
Well, Scott, Vicky, I look forward to listening to some tunes tonight. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks, Brendan. Right,
thank you very much, Brendan.
Listening to Vicky Gish, Scott Vaca, and the Every Other Wednesday Session Musicians. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen on NPR One or visit our website WMFE.org for previous episodes. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.